from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In 2008, the Webster Word of the Year was overshare, meaning the providing of excessive personal information. Hal Niedzwiecki tells readers in his book, The Peep Diaries, how we are learning to love watching ourselves and our neighbors and becoming a society immersed, often excessively, in both voyeurism and exhibitionism. Author Naomi Klein calls The Peep Diaries compelling and creepy and links it to a world in profound transformation. We'll hear from Hal Niedzwiecki, as well as the head of a Harvard study that measured the use of Twitter to find out who tweets and about what. Forum is next, right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum. Hal Niedzwiecki is the founder of Broken Pencil Magazine, also the author of a book called Hello, I'm Special, How Individuality Became the New Conformity, and We Want Some Too, Underground. And in his latest book, The Peep Diaries, How We're Learning to Love Watching Ourselves and Our Neighbors, he exposes the phenomenon of our peeping Tom culture and the growing phenomenon of oversharing, providing via social networks, reality television, memoirs, and tabloids, an excess of, well, personal information. And Hal Niedzwiecki joins us for this Forum Hour here in studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Glad to have you here. And those perhaps of a less literary nature might not know how Peep Diaries has to clever resonances of Samuel Pepys' diaries. I commend you for that. People should be reading Samuel Pepys' diaries still, but probably very little of that going on. I guess I want to just jump into this whole idea, though, of the peeping Tom culture. It's voyeuristic, but it's also exhibitionistic. And you've got people who are confessing and revealing themselves as a form of entertainment. But a lot of this is just crushingly vapid, boring stuff and self-involved stuff. I mean, it's kind of both extremes, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you have everything from today I'm eating soup to I'm going to kill myself in 5 minutes. Please watch. You know, the gamut.
A real episode that occurred, in fact.
Absolutely. A real thing that occurred on Justin, through the auspices of the Justin TV website, which gives people their own television, online television channels. You know, there's such a wide array of material which is being put out there, and it all equalizes. It all seems the same. So you have the mundane details of people's lives, and then you have these astonishing videos of car accidents. And people just sort of filter through everything and go, oh, that was fun. That was entertaining. What's next?
But it makes us more virtual. I mean, that's kind of always been the bottom line for me. I remember talking about these things with Howard Rheingold when they were just starting to take shape and saying, What's happening in interpersonal communication here about sitting down and the kind of intimacy that can come from a close conversation, maybe even of the sort that you and I are having here this morning? It's all pretty much getting packed off into this strange world of the virtual.
Yeah, I mean, I really think people always say, well, what's going to happen next? Which is maybe weird to jump to right at the beginning of the interview. But what's going to happen next? We are becoming virtual beings. And more people really feel like they don't exist if they don't have a sort of parallel virtual personality that is constantly documenting what their flesh being is doing. So you go to a party now, and half the people at the party are tweeting and status updating and text messaging and uploading pictures and videos. They're not there. They're in the virtual world.
It's infectious, and it's in some ways dissociative. But of course, it's also a lot of fun, a lot of entertainment, as you point out in your book. TV kind of you seem to feel is the genesis behind all this.
Yeah, I really think we can sort of – in the book, I trace the line kind of from photography to moving pictures to television. And when you get into this world of television where the ubiquity of the flickering image, the small image, the mundane image, all the great TV shows that we think about are set in the home. They are about so-called ordinary people revealing the problems of their lives. that sinks in our minds. And then that merges with celebrity culture, which has become not what a fantastic dancer, what an amazing performance, but what a drug problem, what a train wreck divorce. So that's
all the tabloid side of things.
Sure, but it's not the tabloids. I mean, it's television, new. It's mainstream. They feed each other, but you get this material on the news, not just on the tabloids anymore. And so it all comes together into this big this kind of idea that other people's lives are entertaining, and we should watch them, and we should also produce our own entertainment, our own channel based on our problems in life.
Which means Andy Warhol was indeed right, of course, about everybody having their moment of fame or their seconds of fame. But a lot of television has been, in terms of this meme, cultural meme that you're talking about, has been exacerbated to a much greater degree by reality television, mm-hmm. which is cheaper to produce, of course. And yet the irony for me has always been in the fact that so much reality TV is scripted. We're reading now, in fact, I was reading about this guy on the Hill, Spencer, who everybody loves to hate. And
right.
he's saying, well, you know, they were making me be this kind of character. I didn't necessarily want – they were making him be that kind of character. I don't know, you know, that they can do that or to what extent they can do that, but – they're doing it.
Oh, they can do it, and they do it. And I mean, there's two points to make here. One is people play along, and in order to prolong their life on the show, they will fall into acting that character. So if the producers assign them the role of the evil character, the histrionic shrew, whatever it is, they'll be that person. In the book, I talked to a fellow who is one of the first people to go on the Fox show Trading Spouses, where the wives are exchanged and you see what happens. And he talked to me about, on the one hand, there is this sort of ambivalence. What is this about, and why would anyone want to watch this? But then once it starts, there's this compulsion to continue. And he said, even though they made his wife look terrible, they sent her off to a Christian community in California, and they were in suburban Maryland, and they were liberal Jews, and this was a conservative Christian community, and so they made the wife look very kind of self-absorbed and whiny, and he kind of not a nice person. And I said, so you wouldn't do it again, right? This was a bad experience. He said, oh no, I would do it again. I loved it. You know, you had the cameras and they're paying you and all the attention. And his only regret was that...
Limos too, probably.
Everything, of course. Yeah. His big regret was that he didn't big it up more, that he didn't hype it up more and have more dramatic scenes with the woman that had been brought in to be the new mom in his family. So the addictive nature of it and what it teaches people, which is,
whatever you can to get attention.
Exactly. Do whatever you can to get attention.
It's a Jerry Springer phenomenon in some ways, isn't it? But it's also kind of a striptease and an excess. And you'd think maybe we'd reach a tipping point with this, or perhaps there is a tipping point to it. We're talking about bottoming out with an economy. Maybe we need to bottom out with this sort of thing. Because, I mean, I was thinking about the fact this whole phenomenon called sexting. And I know a lot of my listeners probably don't even know what that is. Mm. But it is a phenomenon, isn't it?
It is a phenomenon. I mean, it's mostly younger teenagers who are taking pictures of themselves nude, and then they text the pictures to their friends. Often they'll text it to just their boyfriend or their girlfriend. But of course, it immediately starts to spread everywhere. And that is symptomatic of the whole idea of peep culture, which is you're taking these images, you're putting material out there. You think it's ephemeral and it's going to go away. And it feels like that. It's gone tomorrow, except it also stays around forever.
These guys on Facebook who, go into drunken kind of craziness, and then suddenly they're looking for a job and they find those pictures and so forth.
I think of it as really a clash of values. So on the one hand, we have a culture that is constantly telling us, reveal all, and the more you reveal, the more attention you'll get and the more likely you could achieve celebrity status. Then you have another aspect of our culture, which is saying, we're judging you not based on your celebrity status, but on your capacity to fit into our bureaucratic capitalist system as a worker or a someone who wants to become a worker. So you have kids who are finding out that they're being rejected for college. They're not getting the jobs that they are applying for, even though they're super qualified for them. Or even they are getting in trouble with the law based on things that they were encouraged to do and told was kind of a good idea to do this on other levels.
Talking to Hal Niedzwiecki, he is a writer, a cultural commentator, an editor, and author of The Peep Diaries, How We're Learning to Love Watching Ourselves and Our Neighbors. He'll be reading on Monday evening, this evening, June 8th, 7:30 at the Booksmith in the Upper Haight, and you can meet him then. Of course, more and more people meeting on Facebook and on MySpace and all of these kinds of things. And there's a lot of dangers in that. I mean, we're noticing now, for example, I mean, there's all this stuff about Craigslist, but the same kind of dangers certainly apply here.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, you don't really know. I talk to people and they'll say, oh, I have rules about who I'm going to add as my Facebook friend. I'm only going to add people that I've met, or I'm only going to add people that I've had a drink with. And I say, okay, why? How does that qualify them to get the constant feed of your life that they could then cut and paste into their own blog and make permanent? You know, people have these ideas, but they haven't thought them through as to what qualifies someone to be their Facebook friend or not.
You wrote a very funny piece, in fact, about there's some funny material in here. I love this text message from Amber, by the way. I'll just tease people with that. You know, but you have an article that you wrote, I think it was in the New York Times that I read, where you were talking about inviting all your Facebook friends, all 800 of them, feeling very proud of having 800 Facebook friends to a party. What, one person showed up?
One person showed up. You know, I had gone through a phase in my life. I'd become a father. A lot of my friends had dropped off because they were of the sort of indigent hipster set who were like, fatherhood, I don't know you anymore. And so I was spending a lot of time at home. And all of a sudden, I realized, hey, I have 800 Facebook friends, but I don't have anyone to have a drink with. So I'll merge these two things. And it was a kind of experiment. And I was really shocked by the results because I really did not think for a second that of the 700 or so people I invited, only one would come. That never crossed my mind in a million years. And that's what happened. And I think that to me is the biggest danger of all of this, which is once you start kind of broadcasting your life and other people are following you and you fall into this pattern where you think that you have friends and you think you have community, but when you really need them, are they there? Is it a real community? Do you really have friends? Or do you just have followers who are flipping through your life as
or
if you
virtual
were
friends?
Yeah, you have virtual friends. But what is a virtual friend? You know,
it's not somebody you hang out with usually, is it?
Exactly. It's someone who watches you. It's someone who is peeping your life for their own needs, their own entertainment, and projecting all kinds of desires on you. So, you know, you can have 500,000 people following your Twitter feeds. But if you say, I've broken my leg, you're going to get a lot of people writing back with emoticons with a tear dripping off the smiley face, but no one writing back saying, let me come over and help you change your pants.
Well, this excess in our culture, which is generally what you're getting at here, that separates people even more rather than bring them closer together. And there's a woman that you write about, for example, a middle-class housewife in Vancouver, very, by all standards, middle-class housewife, but secret life of spanking and all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Again, it's this desire to reveal intimacy, and it's really quite revelatory. It reminds me of, one of my Facebook friends, actually, Bob Putnam of Harvard, who wrote that book, Bowling Alone, of how, you know, people who are lonely these days and everything feed off this kind of stuff. Actually, speaking about Harvard, it's a real Polish name morning for us because Misha Pekorski is with us and we wanted to get him on here as well. He's assistant professor of business administration with the strategy unit at the Harvard Business School. He studies online social networks and got some preliminary results of research on Twitter users, which were just released last week. Actually spoke to about 300,000 tweeters, as they're called, in May. And Misha Pekorski, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm okay. You're over at Harvard now, but you used to be here in the Bay Area at Stanford.
I used to, yes, and I actually used to commute to Stanford and listen to your program quite a lot, so I'm very pleased to be here.
Well, we're pleased to have you here. I just want to find out what we've learned from the study that you did. Actually, a lot of it, even though more than half, as I understand it, are women who are tweeting. It's mostly guys talking about themselves.
Well, let me tell you through the entire set, because actually there's quite a lot of results. So I want to make sure that I communicate them well. So first of all, this was research actually that was done with an MBA student of mine, Bill Heil, who took my class here at Harvard Business School. And we're very intrigued by how Twitter was very similar and very different from other social networks and user-generated content sites I studied. And, you know, Twitter's key innovation was that it allows for unidirectional friendships so that you can, for example, see status updates by Beyonce, but Beyonce doesn't necessarily have to see what your status updates are. So that naturally lends itself to following public figures, celebrities, opinion leaders. Like Hal was mentioning, celebrity culture, it fits right in there, right? So this is what we'd call one-to-many mode of communication. But on the other hand, what we saw on Twitter was that Twitter is being used between friends. Pretty much like Facebook would be used, and people would post up the status updates there too. So Bill and I were basically very interested in finding out, you know, what exactly goes on Twitter. So what we did is we actually took a sample of 300,000 Twitter users. We didn't actually talk to them. Twitter, with the new technologies, actually, you can go and find out what people are doing online without actually having to ask them, which is it's sometimes better to just see what they do rather than ask them. And so we found a couple of really fascinating things. The first thing we found was that most of the time people actually don't say much. On average, something like 50% of Twitter users haven't actually tweeted at all, haven't said nothing. On the other hand, there is a group of, I would probably say 10% of top Twitter users that generate a humongous amount of content. I mean, they tweet all the time.
I think you said 10% of users do 90% of the content.
That's correct. Yeah. That's correct. Which is, when you compare it to other online social networks, that's very, very different. On other social networks like MySpace or Facebook, you would probably see something like 10% top users generating anywhere between 30 to 40% of content. So this is very, very concentrated, very much in line with what Hal was describing along the lines of following celebrities or people, you know, a small number of people generating most of the content. The other set of results were around gender. And so what we did is Twitter actually doesn't have a field for gender. You actually have to infer gender. So we took people's names and ran them against a database of highly gendered names. And what we found was basically that it's a set of very interesting results. First of all, there's actually more women than men on Twitter in general. They produce just about as much content as men. There's virtually no differences between men and women in terms of content production. Where there are huge differences is who follows whom. And what we found that was very, very interesting is that on Twitter, it's men that are most likely to follow other men rather than women. And interestingly enough, women are also more likely to follow men than other women, which again stands in a really big contrast to other online social networks where most of the activity is about both men and women following content produced by other women.
So the bottom line is it's very different from normal, what are at least perceived to be normal social networks, and there's more a problem of undersharing.
Oh, that's right. There's a huge amount of undersharing, right? Which I think goes to the point that because Twitter has that sort of broadcast characteristic to it, I think actually it does scare a lot of people away. I think, you know, Hal brought up the point that a lot of people are very interested in becoming celebrities and they really want to be heard by other people. I think from my research, I found that a lot of people are actually quite careful about what they want to disclose about themselves. And the idea that they would actually give out too much information that can be seen by everybody actually puts them off. And that's why you see, for example, more production on Facebook where people know that they have more control over who sees that information and who will use that.
Mishik, where can they get the results from your study? Is it online available?
Yes, it is available online, yes.
And how do they do that? How do they access it?
Oh, they go on my website, which is www.people.hbs.edu/mpiskorski.
And we thank you so much for revealing those results to us.
Thank you. Appreciate your
being with us. That's Mishik Piskorski, who is Assistant Professor of Business Administration with the Strategy Unit at the Harvard Business School. Hal Niedzwiecki is here with us in studio. And, most of these places like I said, like we've said, not undersharing, oversharing.
Well, I mean, I think you've got to take this with a bit of a grain of salt, because we have Twitter over the last year has grown 3,000%. So there's a lot of people who are like my father, who told me, I signed up for Twitter. It's stupid. And he, you know, he forms an account, but he has no idea what to do with it, because he just sort of heard it in the ether and just went there and signed up. So there are a lot of people who are just kind of there, and then maybe they add some people and then they never post. You know, once you start doing it, of course, we're talking about a huge number of people. We're talking about millions of people here. So there is a tremendous amount of uptake here. And sure, you can say, oh, some people are undersharing on Twitter, which is kind of like, I don't, you know.
Well, you're only allowed a certain number of letters anyway.
140.
Yeah.
But you can send as many as you want. So you could do 50, 140 word Twitter character Twitters in a row.
One hopes at least some of this is making people more cogent in terms of communication.
Yeah, they're trimming it down. I mean, I guess the main point that I would make is that, again, there's this question of following other people's lives for the purposes of entertainment. So, you know, we go on Twitter and we're like, who are we going to follow?
That's the peeping side of it. But the other side of it is the people who want to be followed, the narcissism
and
the self-absorption. Right? And also privacy issues here, many of them.
Privacy is a fascinating subject. We need another hour just on privacy. But what I say in the book is that we have been taught in many ways to want privacy, that people, you know, we've always been told your home is your castle. You got to have your house and your alarm system and your fence and your garage, and in your garage, your cars, which is sort of the extension of your castle. And you should achieve the ideal of the celebrity, you know, private island if you can. This is something that is people strive for all their lives. But when they get it, if they're lucky enough to get it, or they get, you know, some suburban approximation of it, or some downtown loft version of it, they find that they are lonely and they are isolated, and that in fact we were never meant to live this way. That, you know, we're basically monkeys. We've evolved from the monkeys, and monkeys spend half their day picking little bits of stuff out of each other. Monkeys groom each other all the time, and that's kind of more how we intrinsically feel like we should live. But we're also taught this other way of living, which is kind of exclusion and being alone, which is why these virtual connective possibilities are so powerful to us.
Well, I'm going to open the phone lines and invite listeners to join this conversation. We're talking about social networks. We're also talking, though, about the voyeuristic and narcissistic culture and all of, for many people, of course, these are network tools and these are very useful kinds of things. But tabloids, memoirs, reality TV, a virtual society we've become. And what does it mean to you? You may want to weigh in here. And if you are involved in tweeting or any of the social networks, you may want to talk about how it serves you, or for that matter, how it doesn't serve you. I'm going to open up the phone lines and cordially invite your calls. Again, it's toll free from wherever you're calling us. And whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius XM satellite, feel free to join the program. 866-733-6786 is the number to join. And again, our toll-free number available to you now, 866-733-6786. You can also join us by email. Our email address is simply forum@kqed.org. We're talking with Hal Niedzwiecki. We also talk with Mieszek Pokorski, who is assistant professor of business administration, headed up a new study on Twitter at the Harvard Business School. And Hal Niedzwiecki's book is called The Peep Diaries, How We're Learning to Love Watching Ourselves and Our Neighbors. When we return, we'll get your calls and emails. Hal's going to be reading on Monday this evening, 7:30 at the Booksmith in Upper Haight. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Hal Niedzwiecki, and he's a writer and the author of The Peep Diaries, How We're Learning to Love Watching Ourselves and Our Neighbors. And we're talking about that whole phenomenon in our culture, not only pop culture, our American civilization, American culture itself, really, and how it's really changed and transformed the culture we live in. We spoke also briefly with Mieszek Skorski, who's assistant professor of business administration with the strategy unit at Harvard. They just did a big study of results of Twitter users. And now we're going to find out what your thoughts are on this whole subject. And let's begin with Elizabeth. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to share some of my experience and get comments about...
Are you going to overshare or undershare?
No. I'm going to probably overshare.
That's the way.
But that is because I consider myself an expert in internet dating. I did it for years as a single mom, older, not being able to or not having any success in meeting single men in the usual way, and not because I didn't want to meet a guy in a bar at 40 and I already knew everybody. So I started internet dating, and it's a fascinating experience, and it was an experiment that ended up in I got married, and I'm very happily married. But I think that's rather unusual in the people that I know that have internet dated, and it was also just it's such a different lifestyle now for anybody that's single to meet people online. And I find that there's this danger of people making up, like you use the term, a virtual life, that really you don't know anything about anybody until you meet them in person and spend time.
You don't even
with
know
them.
What their gender is. I mean, really?
I've been on plenty of met people that I corresponded with online. I saw their pictures, and then I met them in person, and it was a 20-year-old picture or 75 pounds earlier kind of thing. But it's just so fascinating, and I wonder if there's just any other conversation about how it has affected the fiber sort of our social networks and how we meet people.
That's the big question. Your story. I mean, it's a nice happy ending, but it's anomalous, isn't it, Hal? I mean, most of these people don't really wind up in cyber dating, finding happily ever after, despite, you know, all that hype that we get from some of these cyber dating outfits.
Yeah, I think it's
find
really,
your soulmate.
It's really hard to find, you know, to break through the morass and find the real people who are really looking for meaningful relationships. But I mean, cyber dating is the precursor to social networking. It was a very, very similar. You join, you add friends, you chat. And again, at some point it breaks down because you realize that the people who you're chatting with are not your friends. They're not your potential mates necessarily, your potential life partner. They have a virtual identity. They are who they want to be, maybe more than who they actually are.
And that story she told is a very common one of a picture from 30 years before,
very
or
common.
A guy who turns up, you know, looking like Yul Brynner or Telly Savalas, and he had a full set of hair and a picture he sent. And
I mean, you look at what's happening on Facebook, and people are listing their likes and dislikes and their hobbies and this, and it's very, very much like the kind of thing you would do if you were setting up a profile on an online dating service.
Alex, join us. You're on. Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I've certainly found Twitter to be useful for grassroots organizing and around issues of social change. We just started tweeting. We're caravanforjustice.com, caravan4justice. And we organized to go up to Sacramento just recently, and someone had missed one of the bus stations in the Bay Area and managed to tweet me, and I was able to direct them as to, you know, the next station to go to, and managed to meet up with them, and didn't have their cell phone number, anything, but the fact that we were connected through Twitter.
Yeah, Alex, in fact, when I said I found Twitter stupid, I wasn't talking about for political organizing, because you look at what Gavin Newsom's been able to do with it.
You know, you can do tremendous things with these social networks if you're focused and you know what you're trying to achieve. Unfortunately, most people are not focused and do not know what they're trying to achieve. And the other thing about that is there's been several interesting studies about – how people have tried to organize for charitable causes and political causes on Facebook and have failed miserably. They can get tons of people will sign up and say, yes, I support this cause. But to actually take that step and go and donate money or to show up somewhere and do something concrete that shows a real meaningful support, that doesn't happen as much. So I think, again, you know, we have these singular moments of success, like some one guy misses the bus and a group gets organized. But overall, I really question whether or not social networking can lead to meaningful, real community involvement.
Well, here's a criticism. One of our listeners, Matt, says, you seem to have more and more shows that talk about how the activities of the young are replacing quality life with something shallow and empty. Just because we add a new technology doesn't mean old behaviors are dying out. Facebook doesn't stop people from talking face to face. People still take walks, even though the car has been around a while. It's good to have shows on new stuff. I'm a little disappointed. They always feel like an old person's fear and nostalgia.
Hmm. Well, I, you know, there's...
You're a pretty young guy, though.
I don't think of myself as a 90-year-old, an octogenarian going around the kids today. You know, I think of it like TV. When we introduced television in the 50s and it penetrated every American household very quickly, no one could ever have anticipated that television would lead to such immense declines in voting, to fragmented family life where everyone has their own TV watching their own show, to TV dinners, to the rise of obesity and anorexia. No one could ever have predicted these things. And so those are some of the questions that I want to raise in the book and right here, which is not, it's the kids are doing some silly thing with technology. It must be bad. It's, what is the long-term impact of introducing these technologies, the predictions that we, you know, the things that can happen that we have no idea what can happen. And we're starting to see all kinds of strange things that no one knew this would happen when they said, let's do online dating.
Well, we both agreed that it seems to create a phenomenon of virtual reality often replacing, but there's some protests from some listeners. Here's another listener who writes, Facebooking alone was the thought I'd had prior to your mention of bowling alone, and it strikes me as very apropos. Oddly, I found as a longtime geek, techie, and online guy, my social networks over the past several years have been increasingly real world, local, and activities based. Online still exists, certainly, but it's just an element of my socializing, not a principal focus. That's healthy. Another listener, Lou, writes, this reminds me of the popular acronym TMI, too much information. I feel it's a symptom of the fractured society where we're in touch with more people all the time and far too few really intimately. Plus, typing on a computer where there is no listener to respond allows people to be unaware of the effects of their sharing. It contrasts to the old world village when people didn't travel far and knew everyone in the area well. Now we don't even know our next door neighbors sometimes and need an outlet for the intimate details of our lives, thus too much detail inappropriately shared with near strangers. For what it's worth, I try to avoid blogs and all the newer social networking as email is just about right for me.
Hmm. I mean, that's a great point. You know, when I sat down with the guys who created Twitter, and I sat down with them a couple of years ago before Twitter.
What were their names again?
Don't do this to me. I'm terrible with names. Jack.
His stone is one of them, yeah.
Jack Dorsey and another fellow. Apologizing to them. But one of the things they said to me was, people are going to love Twitter and sign up for this because it is connection with low expectation. In other words, you put this material out there, other people read it, nobody expects anything from this connection, which is at once fascinating and profoundly sad that this is an attraction to people to be able to connect to so many other people and not have to expect, you're not expected to do anything. And this mention of kind of old style community, it was never that way. If, you were connected and everything was expected of you. If your neighbor was sick, you had to go over there and help them.
Here's Jim in Oakland who writes, is there any evidence that the growth of trivial communication displaces more intimate conversation? I recently met an online friend for the first time and was immediately able to delve into deeper, more intimate topics because I was familiar with the trivial stuff. Other people there thought we had been best friends for years and were surprised we had just met. I'd say this new communication complements rather than replaces more intimate forms of communication.
That, which is an argument that a lot of people make, that it is a complement and a way to deepen relationships, but I'm skeptical of that.
Well, another listener, Rick, writes, I'm reminded of Jim Carrey's movie a few years ago where everyone filled their lives by watching someone else live his. It's sad that our society has become so shallow that we actually believe people are interested in the trivialities of our daily lives. It keeps us from actually doing anything. I've avoided my wife's encouragement to get a Facebook account, and I have no interest in a Twitter account. I'm a reasonably private person, and my life is fairly normal. I would rather have a handful of real friends and that I see on a regular basis rather than the hundreds of Facebook virtual friends that have no true relationship with me. So getting all these kind of range of responses, as you might have probably expected. Here's Ken in Santa Cruz who says, great show. Please talk about the prevalence of the word branding as it relates to this discussion. Mm-hmm. It has now become acceptable to talk about your personal brand instead of who you are and what you do. Branding is applied to everything from people to political parties to religion, and it seems that no one winces anymore when they hear it. All is reduced to this corporate marketing term that implies everything and everyone in life should be viewed primarily as an opportunity to promote oneself.
Great, great point. And one of the things that I find most most concerning about the rise of peep culture is exactly that, that people are out there forming a brand, and we're talking about human beings, and we're talking about the penetration of this corporate ideology to the very core of our individuality. And those two things, I don't think, go well together in the long term.
And we go to more call. A call from Windsor, not Windsor, Ontario. You may have noticed Hal's a boat. He's a Canadian from Ontario. Robert from our Windsor in Bay Area. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, and thank you. And at risk of kind of one-upping the banality of a status update, I'd like to just mention a dream and a neurosis that I have now because of Facebook. And I really enjoy Facebook a lot. For me, it takes the concept of a reunion from happening in a discrete time and place to happening continuously through my life. And I have this idea that I connect with old friends not knowing the context of the reunion. So
I think we got the gist. We got a lousy line here, but how
the high school reunion syndrome.
Yeah.
That all these people from your past are adding you, and you add them, and then you all sit around looking at each other's pictures and saying, "Oh, he's fat and he has what looks to be a pretty bad job."
Have you seen that brilliant video from the BBC where the guy?
Oh yeah, yeah.
He says, "Don't you remember we comes to this guy's home? We sat next to each other in the third grade. I was in the, yeah. I don't think I liked you." So somebody's writing on his wall outside his home, and anyway.
Yeah. That's a funny video. And again, you know, it's this question of what are we actually trying to achieve here? What are we meaning? Are we making meaningful connections? Are we reuniting people? In some cases, yes, absolutely. Most people who I talk to about this say, I don't want to add these people. I don't want them peering into my life. And yet we do because we're compulsively extending our brand. We have this idea that the more ads we make, the more people who follow us and watch us, in some way, the better off we'll be.
I think if you're going to use Facebook or any of these things as a network, it's one thing. But if you're going to use it as, a place for friends, then it ought to be a place for friends, don't you?
But the lines are blurred.
But that too is the case. In fact, they're very blurry. I mean, there are people who are almost promiscuous about it.
You know, yeah,
anybody they don't even know, they'll accept as a friend on Facebook, and they'll do it because maybe there's a mutual friend or something like that, and then they have, like you did, 800 friends suddenly, yeah, but how many of them show up to the party?
Yeah, right? You do it because you want to have more followers. I mean, there are CEOs who are blogging, who are blurring this line. One minute they're talking about some new line of product they're developing, and the next minute they're putting up snapshots of their family vacation, and you're thinking to yourself, you know, again, overshare. Don't you understand what you're doing here? And literally, people are out there, and they do not understand. They have not thought through all the implications. So it's, and then you know, you're talking about these masters of industry using Twitter inappropriately. Let alone people who don't have a staff of public relations and marketing professionals to advise them.
We'll get more of your calls on. We'll go to Shannon next. Good morning, Shannon.
Good morning. I just wanted to say, you know, as far as social networking goes, I don't see how there's so many people out there with so much time on their hands. I mean, I've had so many people invite me to go on Facebook, so I finally tried it, but I just don't get it. I'd rather email or call somebody, and Facebook is just so impersonal.
Well, question for you, Shannon. Do you feel left out?
Do I what?
Do you feel left out?
Absolutely. absolutely not. I really am completely uninterested in it. I don't get it. I don't have time for it.
you know, what's funny is I meet all these characters in the book who are so heavily into peep culture, and every single one of them talks about the addictive nature of it. So once you start, it becomes very, very difficult to stop.
Depends. let me go. Is there a 12-step program? Rama, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. First of all, thank you for the fascinating subject. I would like to point out one thing that we have seen in presidential election in U.S. that everybody points their opinion, but this is more interesting even for countries like Iran that they don't have, that ordinary people have a way to basically voice their opinion, and it's happening in Facebook now. In there's a presidential election in Iran.
It's Friday.
Yeah. And it's interesting that how much everybody basically participating and exchanging information with each other. I think it's very helpful for the society.
Good point. As I said, I think you have to separate these things in terms of network tools, politically, the political from the personal, really. I mean, in the 60s, we said the political is the personal, but they really have to be separated when we're having a discussion of this sort.
Again, before we just jump to the next call, again, there's a blurring there because people will go out there and they'll be filming everything they see. And, you know, I have a video up on my blog at the Coachella Music Festival of this, the naked wizard who gets tasered by the police. And as he's really not doing anything except disrobing. But the police, they handcuff him and taser him repeatedly. And there's a ring of observers snapping pictures and making videos, which they will then immediately upload to YouTube. So in their minds, maybe they think they're doing something, that they are in some way, you know, documenting this situation. But you can also say this is political as passive.
We'll go to more calls here, and we go next to Corey. Morning.
Good morning. Talking about the personal side of using these communication tools, not the political activism side, mm-hmm. It seems to me that from my experience with LinkedIn, Facebook, MySpace, all these different, at one time, hot tools, that they have a moment that they pop for political, personal communication, and then they disappear because they become uncool to be someone, because they get so played out that your mom's on Twitter or Oprah's Twitter tweeting, that at a certain point, the cool people stop doing it. And then that wave transfers across America, and then it only becomes a tool that's used by political activists and that group. So my question is, after that wave breaks and it's no longer used, those people who were once really big into it that you've both described as narcissistic and maybe exhibitionist, is there an actual belief that they have carryover communication inabilities, or is it just something they did for a while and then they're done with? I mean, do you actually think it impairs in any way their communication abilities?
I think that people are using these services and they will simply migrate to the next big thing. We've moved from Friendster to MySpace to now Facebook and Twitter. So, you know, people just will move very quickly to the next thing. And the bigger issue that you're sort of, the bigger question here is, yes, people believe that they have followers, that if they have 100 people reading their blog, I have one woman who I talk about in the book who went through a gastric bypass surgery and has blogged about this experience extensively, including videos. She genuinely believes that she could be the next kind of Oprah for the gastric bypass surgery set. And that she's
sort of thing you know, want to spend your time reading about too, gastric.
It's a strange
for
thing.
Entertainment's sake, yeah. Some more positive words about all this, though. Here's Leslie who writes, "I just like to put in a positive word about social networking in light of all the hand wringing about it today on your show, and that is sites like MySpace Music are invaluable for young musicians like my high school age son and his band, who are just starting out and trying to get their music out to the wider world. For example, his band will be playing at a local music festival, and the festival's website is able to put a link to their music on their band list page, along with many others. Thus, at some point, they may achieve critical mass." talk about achieving, as your guest just was. And here's Dana, who says, I use Facebook to connect with out-of-state cousins I haven't seen for over 40 years. And then on the other hand, here's Allison, who says, most of my Facebook friends are people I'm currently close to or those I knew previously, and I found that the tenor of those relationships has changed. Instead of having a phone conversation every few months, I now follow my friends' postings on Facebook. Consequently, I know their favorite TV shows and have seen pictures of their dogs, which is fun, but I don't necessarily know the important things. I'm a case in point. All my Facebook friends know that I have a cold today, but very few of them know that I got laid off 6 months ago. It's just something I didn't want to post, and since I don't talk to people regularly anymore, I don't get around to sharing. So I found that I know different things about my friends than I used to know.
See, that's fascinating.
Well, we'll hear from some more of our listeners, and let's hear from you. Daniel, morning.
Oh, good morning. I am a little disappointed by the pejorative and judgmental tone here, and I wanted to offer a different perspective. Let's see. The point is that I have known people, many people, who've had successful interactions and relationships formed through the dating networks, for example. And the way I look at it is somewhat analogous to chemical catalysis, whereby kind of confining the search space, all of a sudden these chemicals can find each other that would have a heck of a hard time, and it speeds up the reaction rate. Who says that the traditional way of meeting people is going to allow you to meet the people that would be your best friends or your closest lovers? Maybe these social networks and these dating networks actually allow things to happen that never would have happened before. It allows you to meet a wider range of people so that with judicious use of them, you can do much better than with the traditional format. It's an interesting augmentation to the traditional way of meeting people.
I think that's a valid point. I hope we don't sound like we're too naysaying here, because some people use these personally in very effective ways and have used them, like the caller who said, you know, she found her ideal mate and all that sort of thing.
I think we are kind of teetering to the negative, because the negative is more provocative and fascinating. But a journalist asked me the other day.
It's also not when you read people tweeting things like "I'm eating a cucumber" or stuff. I mean, it's
well, that's what I want to speak to, because, you know, a journalist asked me the other day, status updates. I'm so sick of them. I don't want to hear my friend is going to spin class, and I said, well, you can look at it that it's annoying and it's just this barrage of useless information, or you can look at it as a kind of virtual grooming, that we are, in fact, doing this. And there's a sort of beauty to it, to just knowing the little mundane things about other people's lives that connects us to the larger human experience. So I think
the quotidian.
I mean, I think there is a beauty to it. But as the caller kind of said, if you use it judiciously, if you use it thoughtfully, things can turn out great for you, and it can be an amazing tool. But our culture does not encourage judicious, thoughtful use of these different social networks and platforms.
Well, here's Paul, who writes, there is a cultural problem, no doubt about that, but I think the problem stems from the television. The social networking has moved people away from the television to an interactive medium. There's at least a chance of meeting the characters you engage with via social networking. Well, we'll hear from some more of our listeners. Larry, morning.
Good morning. I'm a parent, and just last week my son was out of school for the first time, and as a result, I have a backbeat going on.
I don't even know what that means, but I guess that means we're going to have to say goodbye to you. Let me go to another caller. Beth, hi.
Yes. I was invited to one of my friends contacted me and said, oh, I'm on Facebook, and I thought it would be great because we were not in contact on a regular basis, and she'd had a baby and thought it would be fun to look into her life. And so I went to follow the link, and it said, you must join Facebook in order to see her postings. And that really turned me off, and I sent her an email saying, you know, I'm sorry I can't do this because I have to join and I don't want to put out my personal information out there. And so that's my comment, and I was disappointed by that, and I welcome any comments that you all have.
Okay, Beth, we thank you for the call.
It's an all or nothing scheme, because we look at these things as free services that are being provided to us. Why are they providing us these amazing free services? What are they getting out of it? And a lot of us forget that there's data mining going on, there's ad placements happening, there is coagulating every single word that ever goes through Twitter and selling it to different places. You know, when you go to join these services, you see this, whatever, 3,000-word privacy statement and statement of use. Nobody reads it. There was a study that showed that if you read every one of those terms of use services things before you use the service, you would lose an entire year of your life.
I read one recently. Somebody invited me to join something called Tagged. I never heard about this. And you read the provision of services, and there's actually a charge for joining this thing. I mean, it's short enough, and it's right in the first paragraph, but I'm thinking, why would you join one of these networks when all of them are for free?
So
why would you have to pay?
Well, it's nominally for free, but in the background, things are going on that we often don't think about, and that's another factor of peep culture, that we're peeping ourselves, we're being encouraged to peep ourselves and each other, and meanwhile, there are corporate entities that are trying to figure out, how can we use this information? How can we grab it, resell it, profit from it? These services do not exist out of love. You
might as well plug your website. It's the peepdiaries.com, as long as we're talking about promoting websites here. There's also this whole phenomenon of in virtual culture and all that we're talking about here, flaming. I think that a lot of people write things, and there are a lot of, you know, these kind of nasty, gossipy Perez Hilton type websites out there that just enjoy going after people if they're celebrities in one way or the other, but also just saying things that would be very reluctant to say face-to-face. I mean, you have a kind of protection and armor when you do it on the web.
Yeah, psychologists call it a disinhibition factor, that you forget that there is another person out there. It's all about you. You're staring at a screen. You do not have a sense that there's someone on the other line of all those wires, and what you're about to type in is going to, you know, could break down, you know, could cause them real mental anguish. And that I think is, again, it's another consequence as we move to a peep culture, another thing that we haven't really thought through. It's the same thing when we see pictures of a celebrity in anguish and we're enjoying that. It changes our whole perception of what is right and wrong in humanity.
Well, as people have said in the emails and calls, we've maybe highlighted a lot of the negative, but there are some certainly positive things too in this, and it's been a good, rich discussion. I thank you. Spent the hour with Hal Niedzwiecki. We also talked with Mieszek Pokorski, who did the study for Harvard Business School on tweeting. And Hal's book is published by San Francisco's own City Lights publisher. Thank you for the hour. And thank you, our listeners. Back with you if all goes according to plan on tomorrow. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.